patient with us and the delay in having your testimony. Dr. Sherrard, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And we, of course, had a visit with you during December, but I thought maybe if you wanted to, before you started the supplemental request, just bring us up to date with any information that you have.
Madam Chairman, I would be happy to. And I'm Brent Sherrard. I'm the director of the Wyoming Department of Health and the state health officer. Pleasure to be here with you. In December, I had my folks introduce themselves. I will hold off on that today because I know the hour is getting late. But I have Terry Green, our state Medicaid agent, and Bob Peck, my chief financial officer here. So if I might just make a few comments to begin with, I appreciate that. In December, we handed out, I think, a very good document that Terry and her staff put together, and I think you might have it there in your hand.
Yep.
on the basic facts of Medicaid. I think that really does simplify it as well as you can simplify Medicaid. It's an incredibly complicated program, I think, but we have people that understand it very well, and I've appreciated what they've done. Basically, the Wyoming Department of Health's budget currently is about $1.5 billion for the biennium. That represents, we calculate, around 20.1% of the entire state budget. About two-thirds of that's Medicaid. It's approaching $1 billion. And, again, that's actually 63.9%. I think one of the important things that I would like to, again, stress is that 88% of the department's budget goes to direct providers, for direct provider care. And, Madam Chairman, if I could hand out, there's actually a document here. The front page shows the amount received by providers in Wyoming counties, and it goes through all 23 counties. And then behind that is actually the top 10 providers per county. So I think there are many, many, many more providers than what you'll see on this list that receive benefits or receive payments from Medicaid, but I think you'll be able to see what the top providers are in your individual counties. So I'll let you peruse that as I talk, because I know that that'll give you some information about your own respective areas and counties.
Thank you, Dr. Sherrard.
You bet. I think, as everyone knows, Medicaid is roughly a 50-50 partnership between the federal government and the state of Wyoming. And because of that, we have a lot of restrictions and rules that are placed upon the department by the federal government. And we have a state plan, and when we make changes in the Medicaid program, we do have to run these through for approval through the federal government as a state plan amendment. And those are complex procedures. They're slow procedures, and the system doesn't move very quickly. I think really some of the things that I would like to discuss, and I think we're going to be looking at this budget today with a lot of concern. I have a lot of concern about it. I've had a lot of concern about it. And the growth, there's no question, is based upon the increase in enrollments in the Wyoming Medicaid program. From 2008 through 2010, we've seen a 19.4% increase in enrollments. And we believe that that's primarily related to the economy, to the increased unemployment rate that's occurred. And, you know, in looking at other states, that's exactly what almost all of them have seen as well. Wyoming is definitely not the Lone Ranger out there. Idaho's got huge problems. Utah's got problems. You know, I can go around the states in the periphery of Wyoming, and they all have very, very similar problems with the same issues. I think that just a couple of facts about Medicaid, because I think that there are sometimes misperceptions of who actually is covered under Medicaid. Basically, in the Wyoming Medicaid program, 58% of the expenditures, 58% of the expenditures are for the age blind and disabled. So that's people in nursing homes, that's the developmental disability population. 15%, but only 15% are actually of the eligibles are actually in that category. So it's a relatively small group, numbers-wise, as far as number of eligibles, but they do require, they do take by far and away most of the expenditures, or over half of the expenditures. We do cover a lot of children. 63% of our Medicaid eligibles are kids, but basically 28% of the expenditures are for children. So you know, if you look at that, 58% for the age blind and disabled, 28% for children, that's 86% of our budget goes for those two groups. Just to give you a couple of other, I think, kind of interesting statistics, and you're probably aware of some of these, 63% of all nursing facility beds in Wyoming are occupied by Medicaid residents. Medicare does not pay primarily for nursing home expenses. That's a liability that's shifted to the Medicaid program. And our nursing homes are heavily dependent, as you can see, on the Wyoming Medicaid program for their viability. And I think if you look at that, the charts that I sent out, you'll see a lot of nursing homes on that as in the top 10 provider groups. I think most people are aware now that about 45% of all Wyoming births are paid for by the Wyoming Medicaid program. And that is an amazing, I think.
Dr. Sherrard,
yes.
Can you repeat that?
I apologize. What percent was
45%,
that?
45%, roughly, Senator, roughly, Representative, excuse me, roughly 45% of Wyoming births are covered by the Medicaid program. And that is not that unusual nationwide. It's high. It's obviously, I think, a fairly staggering statistic, but that is very consistent across the United States. In fact, Texas is even higher than that. Medicaid pays for about 12% of all hospital care in Wyoming. Again, if you look at your list of providers there, you'll see your hospital's probably pretty close to the top on most of the counties. The Wyoming physicians receive about 8.8% of their income from the Wyoming Medicaid program. And then the developmental disability providers receive nearly 100% of their income from the Wyoming Medicaid program. So as you can see, we've got a group of providers in Wyoming that many rely heavily on the Wyoming Medicaid program. Others do rely on it, but to a lesser extent. So I think it's just some general information that I think might be useful.
Dr. Sherrard, Senator Meyer has a question for you.
Yeah, Dr. Sherrard, was that 8.8% that physicians?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, 8.8% of Wyoming physician reimbursement is for Medicaid. So, you know, you've got Medicare, which is probably a much bigger player, private insurance, and then, of course, the uninsured. So, but about 8.8% of all physician income in Wyoming comes from the Wyoming Medicaid program.
Go ahead.
And then I would guess that 8.8% obstetricians is fairly large percentage of the 8.8.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, I don't know if we have that figure, but they are heavily dependent on the Wyoming Medicaid program as well. And you know, just a little caveat here, an anecdotal experience. I was speaking not long ago with a obstetrician in Riverton, and the legislature fortunately had given the obstetricians in Wyoming an increased rate to cover Wyoming Medicaid. And the doctor came up to me and he said, "Thank you so much, because that allowed me to get a partner to take some of the burden off on the call schedule." So I just wanted to throw that out while I was thinking of it, because it is an important part of obstetrical care in Wyoming. Just to get really down to, I think, what the nitty-gritty is here, you know, as we've watched this problem develop over the last, I mean, I've been the Department of Health director now for coming up on 6 years, and And we've watched and looked for ways to mitigate the financial impact of this problem over the last 6 years since I've been with the department. And really, there's four things that really affect the Wyoming Medicaid budget. It's really not that complicated as far as understanding what generates, what causes, creates the expenditures. The first really is administrative costs, which actually is quite low. Our administrative overhead is 4.82%. I'm very proud of that percentage. I think that Terry does an excellent job in the Wyoming Medicaid program keeping administrative burden low. It actually was 5.62% the year before. So we have actually streamlined that process a little bit. That doesn't represent a huge amount of our budget, but it obviously when you're administering a program like the Wyoming Medicaid program, that's a place that you have to look. Secondly, is eligibility. And we really rack our brains on this eligibility issue. I think, as you know, we have one of the most conservative Medicaid programs in the United States, and I'm thankful that we do, or we would be, we would have more problems budgetarily than we do right now. The legislature last year considered introducing a bill that would change eligibility. The problem with that is based on the ARRA, which is the stimulus funds, and the ACA, which is the Health Care Reform Act, if we would have changed eligibility, there's a great likelihood that we would not have been eligible for the stimulus funds. And our stimulus funds so far have amounted to $130 million from the feds. So we're handcuffed from that perspective. I mean, there's still things in eligibility that we can do. For example, we've been having ongoing discussions with the Department of Family Services, which does Wyoming Medicaid eligibility, and we're looking for ways to even consider, I think, and this should be considered, bringing the eligibility into the Wyoming Department of Health so that the tail is wagging the dog, so to speak, rather than have eligibility out here in the Department of Family Services. Why not put it together where it makes sense? The other area of eligibility that I think there might be some low-hanging fruit is in, as you may or may not know, when an individual qualifies for the Wyoming Medicaid program, their eligibility is good for 1 year. And we know that there are people that come and go with when they get a job or they lose their job. You know, it's just impossible right now with the technological system that we have, which dates back to 1986, that's part of it, to really look at eligibility more often than yearly. But I think that's something that we have to do because I just think that's good fiscal management. So we've talked about eligibility and some of the challenges there. We've talked about the administrative side. Optional services, and we've got a handout if you'd like to see what the optional services are in the Wyoming Medicaid program. There's basically mandatory services, which the feds say you have to cover, and then there's optional services, which over the years the Wyoming legislature has put into effect. And that's a legislative that's the in the purview of the legislature to put in those optional services.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator.
Dr. Sherrard, on the optional services, would that affect our federal or RF funding if those were changed?
Madam Chairman and Senator Meyer, if we change the eligibility for the optional services, I think it would. I don't know otherwise. Terry, you want to?
Ms. Green?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, for the most part, there's very little correlation between an eligibility and how you qualify and are eligible for Medicaid and the services that you receive. So the optional services, the answer 99.9% is no, that if we change those, it would not jeopardize our federal funding, our enhanced RF funding.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
And Dr. Shore, did you bring a handout for the committee on the optionals, or did you just want to maybe give us a few of what that would be considered just for the committee?
Madam Chairman, those optional services are in this blue book that we went through previously, and they were in that very front section on... on page 5.
Right, okay. So the committee, you've had a chance to look at that. Any questions at this moment of Dr. Shroy or Terry? Okay, continue.
Okay, Madam Chairman, so the fourth area that you can actually make an impact is provider rates, what you pay providers for the services that are delivered. As you know, last year we made a 10% across the board rate cut. We cut $43 million out of our budget in the Department of Health, and that was under Governor Friedenthal's direction. And we implemented those cuts, and those cuts were successful. The problem is the override, if you will, of the enrollment really negated a lot of the positive effects of our cuts. I can assure you that I heard a great deal from many of our providers about their concerns about these cuts, and understandably so. We discussed it at great length with them and tried to be as fair and quite frankly as objective as we could, taking into account many things like how much of their income comes from Medicaid. Are they in-state or out-state providers? Try to preserve primary care services in Wyoming and some other factors that we considered in this. So that was, I think, helpful, but obviously we still have a budget concern here. And the governor, and I agreed with him, felt that we did not want to cut further at this time because we do have a fragile provider system out there. And one of the challenges of my job is trying to maintain access for our clients and maintain the provider base that we need, and that is a balancing act that I encounter each and every day in my capacity. So I think, you know, those are really, Madam Chairman, the four ways that you can actually reduce expenditures in the Medicaid program.
Thank you, Dr. Schwartz. Do you find that the system for providers has become more fragile as the economy has been stagnant and the enrollments have increased? Do you have a sense of what's going out there in the community services?
Madam Chairman, if I understand your question correctly, I think that we're starting to see some concern with payments from the Wyoming Medicaid program. And specifically, I received a letter from a nursing home in Wyoming where they're cutting back the number of Medicaid clients they have by about 30, I think was the number that they gave me, because of reimbursement. Now, we still have been able to maintain, I think, access pretty well with most of our providers. Terry might have some additional information on that. But I think, at least right now, we're not doing too badly as far as access goes. Would you agree with that? Okay.
But
that's,
Meyer.
Yeah.
I guess kind of a follow-up on that, and it's goes into Alzheimer's, where we're getting...
Speak into your mic, please.
Where it goes to Alzheimer's in your nursing homes. I know there's been a requirement, I believe, by the health department to have greater number of CNAs or greater number of providers for those Alzheimer's patients. However, there hasn't been any corresponding increase in payments to the providers for that additional requirement. And I'm not sure how many providers we have in the state now. I think maybe it's three or four. But I do know the one that I'm most familiar with is going to lose somewhere around $500,000 a year because of the extra requirements. And they understand that that's necessary to provide the service that needs to be done. But and then the other area where I've heard of problems are things like your residential treatment centers that are some of them, I guess, have gone out of business. Some of them are close to it, and I know that you guys are getting closer with determining the medical costs on your wraparound payments. But I'm wondering if you could address those two things sometime today about what we could do, because we're going to have more Alzheimer's folks. That's just the demographics that we have. We know that population is going to continue to grow, and we know we're going to have to provide services for them, especially in the Medicaid arena. And I was hoping we could get some suggestions about what we might look toward the future to make sure that our providers at least break even, and also maybe address something about the residential treatment centers in some point in time.
You bet. Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, we sure can, because we spend a lot of time on the residential treatment centers, there's some specific situations that have cropped up with that, as you're probably aware. And, you know, I'll have Terry address the Alzheimer's issue as well. I think one thing that is something that sometimes people don't understand is if you have a high-end client, there are codes that if you bill them appropriately that you can receive improved reimbursement for higher complex patients. I'll leave it up to Terry to kind of talk about that a little bit more, but we do try to help our providers out there with proper coding. Those things come up fairly frequently in the department, so we will address those. Another issue that I wanted to bring up just briefly, and Representative Philp brought this up in December, and I definitely agree with him, and that is the issue of forecasting. There's no question we need to try to be better at forecasting. And I really appreciate Bill Mai and Don Agar and Jill Jensen and Richard Cox's suggestions on working closely with the Craig office and Buck McVeigh and others in state government to try to improve the integration with the Department of Health and those folks that do some of the forecasting. I think that after thinking about the hearing in December, one of the things that we definitely need is more actuarial expertise in the department. So I think that those are some areas that I think particularly that need some focus, because it's really hard to forecast. I think, at least in my opinion, the unemployment, the economy, going south on us happened very quickly, and I'm not sure that it didn't catch a lot of us off guard, not making excuses, but I think it did happen fairly quickly and surprised a lot of folks. So it's obviously an area that we need to really try to do a much better job at.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Sherrard, you pointed out a couple of areas of possible savings.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to get into those, particularly at the beginning, the front end, the gatekeeper to eligibility for Medicaid, and possibly moving that over to the Department of Health,
right,
and also having a much more up-to-date verification, even possibly real-time or however close we can get to verifying that they really are, they do qualify.
Right.
Have you looked into that, and can you give us some, if you have any, that you've perhaps started to develop?
We've been meeting with Department of Family Services, and I'll let Terry answer that question if I might, but we have, Tony Lewis and myself have been a part of those discussions.
Ms. Green?
Madam Chairman, Representative Edmonds, we have since probably over the last year worked with a consultant who's helped us facilitate meetings and planning sessions with the Department of Family Services in order to look at what the requirements are going to be under the Affordable Care Act, also what is available through the federal government right now as match for a new system. What we have in our system is so antiquated we can't even report to this committee what the income levels are for our Medicaid clients. So, yes, we have created a roadmap for how we will go forward with looking for a new system. We are partnering in that also with the Office of the CIO. So the people that need to be involved are involved and are aware that we have a real system issue right now. The federal funding that's in, available for us for a new eligibility system right now is at 90%. So we feel like if, in fact, we're interested and able to take that on and get up to what would be standard, at least in the industry, this would be the time to go forward with that.
And Madam Chair, what Terry was referring to with the 90% is that's a 90% federal match, so 10% state.
For the system, Dr. Schreiber.
For the system.
Right. So what's the next step? Are we waiting as far as transition and getting more information to look at bids and what this would cost? Or?
Madam Chairman, the next step will be to get a blessing from the Office of the CIO that we could go forward.
That's difficult to get.
It is difficult to get. So while we're working on our roadmap, we're trying to involve them in that whole process so there's no surprises anywhere. I don't have any idea what a system would cost. I honestly don't for a state of Wyoming. And that would also we would want to include a look at that point in time as to whether we would want that system to serve as a health insurance exchange for the state of Wyoming.
Right.
So
okay.
There's a lot of different options and opportunities out there right now, and no decisions have been made.
In some of the visits you've had in trying to prepare for this, have you gotten an idea of, for installation, a time frame as once you made decisions, how long that would take for you to make that transition?
Madam Chairman, we don't have an estimate, a formal estimate on implementing a new system, but I would tell you from experience you're talking upwards of 2 years, maybe upwards of 3 years.
And just back on the qualifications with the for eligibility and how antiquated the system is, how does DFS record, or how do they try to maintain that? And obviously they only review once a year, but is it an individual that just does data input? Or
Madam Chairman, that would be correct. It's manually entered into the system. And I do want to clarify that on the 12 months worth of eligibility, that is for the children and family care. That is not for the other groups in the Medicaid program.
Okay. All right. I think we can continue. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see that. Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your handout from December, one of the graphs you show how the
why don't you give the page, Representative Stewart?
Page 12, okay. I guess. You show how the eligibility tracks fairly well with unemployment until you get to a point where then unemployment drops off and eligibility continues to rise on a steep line. And I would think, I guess my question is, that would seem to be the low-hanging fruit. Would you agree? I mean, that shouldn't take a few years to implement, I don't think.
Dr. Short?
What? Madam Chairman, Representative Stewart, could you repeat the question? Sorry. I want to be sure we understand the question.
Exactly. Not in the mic?
Well, you're not. We can't hear you. Too.
Really? Sorry. In that graph on page 12, we show how the eligibility tracks fairly well with unemployment figures until we get to a certain point where unemployment falls off and drops, but eligibility continues to rise. And I guess my question would be that would seem to be the low-hanging fruit to go after first as far as better record keeping and tracking of these folks. You seem to make a case early on that the continued rise in costs tracks with unemployment, and yet once people get on these rolls, then they stay on. We can't end getting them off again. So my question is, how can we better correlate those numbers with the unemployment? And it doesn't seem like that should take 2 years to implement.
Madam Chairman, Representative Stewart, part of the reason this graph looks the way that it does, and maybe the only reason, is that, in fact, a large amount of the Medicaid eligibles stay on for 12 months once they're on. And as this graph is based on 6-month increments, we would expect, if in fact it's truly in line with unemployment, that after another 6 months that would drop, the amount of Medicaid clients that are eligible. Does that answer your question? Does that?
Yes. Once they're on for a year, so perhaps if this graph on page 12 went out further, it might show a decrease then. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Stewart, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get the sense, and I could be wrong, and being a freshman here, you correct me if I'm wrong, that part of the issue also with the gatekeeping is it seems that your ability to track this data is somewhat hampered by the fact that you are not actually enrolling these folks. You're paying claims, but you're not enrolling them. I'm assuming that we could get much more reliable data if you could hook the enrollment to the paid claims and really have a much better understanding in the future. And I'm hoping you're looking at, when you do implement some sort of system, electronic system, that you will go forward and do that.
Madam Chair and Representative Edmonds, I agree with that completely. You know, and I think the other issue that we have too is it's like having your own personal checkbook and having somebody writing checks on it, and you really don't have a whole lot of control on who writes the checks. Because when these people qualify for Medicaid, by law, we have to cover them. And that's the challenge.
Other questions, committee, at the moment? Okay. Continue, Dr. Okay. Short.
Madam Chairman, what I would like to do, and I'll conclude my comments, is I think there's two, at least whatever the committee so desires, but we have, you know, two areas that we need to discuss today, I think, and one is the 09-10 biennium shortfall of $21 million, and then, of course, the supplemental budget request.
Yes.
And, you know, I think just a couple words on the 09-10 biennium. Best estimates around $21 million, and we have looked in the department and applied as much available general fund to this as we had available in the department to do that, and so we're left with the $21 million. We do have $9.7 million that's due to us from the federal government, and that's based on the ARRA, again, the stimulus funds that when we were originally qualified, we had a certain unemployment rate, and then as new unemployment figures became available, and as our unemployment rate increased, there are different tiers, and so the it's interesting, the more people that are unemployed, the more money you get. It's kind of an interesting concept, but there is $9.7 million that is owed to the state of Wyoming from the feds based on the ARRA, and we sent a letter on November 2nd asking for a response. We had not gotten one. I signed a second letter that went out today, and we're aggressively pursuing those funds. So we feel that we will get those funds, that we feel that the state of Wyoming is entitled to them, and we believe that that will take our shortfall there to $11 million. And then, Madam Chairman, the supplemental, and we can get into that whenever you'd like to.
Just on the 9.7, so it's possible that you could get a response or get a check, et cetera, in the time that we're in session, so that we could do an amendment to the budget as we move along.
That would be our hope.
Okay, great. Are there any other questions at this moment on the Medicaid issue? Okay, Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, before we move on, you know, you were talking about four choices to reduce costs, and you mentioned that chart on page 5 of optional services, and it's always been a question of mine, just how much are we responsible for this problem, meaning how much have we exceeded what is absolutely mandatory from the feds. You know, sometimes we find out we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. And has anyone done the analysis, a pie chart, that shows how much of these costs or cost overruns are responsible by legislative mandates for optional services, changes in percent poverty, things like that, Dr. Sharma?
Madam Chairman and Representative Stewart, you know, I don't really look at anybody as being responsible. I mean, the legislature, when these, and I wasn't around when a lot of these optional services were put in, but, you know, I'm sure there was a good reason for it at the time, and I think it was probably a very noble reason, and some of it's probably based on human needs out there and some of the services. So I don't really, I mean, the legislature, of course, has the authority to put in optional services, but they are not the majority of our expenditures. I mean, they contribute, and we have the number on how what percentage that the optional services are, but our mandatory services from the feds, what they mandate that we cover, that's the bigger part of the entire picture. But what we're seeing is an unprecedented, at least in my tenure with the department, growth in enrollment. And I don't think anybody saw it coming or predicted it coming. Other states, same thing. And that's why I don't think there's any other Medicaid program in the country that's not struggling right now. And it's because of, primarily because of enrollment. So, you know, I thank you guys for every day is that you kept the program conservative, because we are one of the most conservative programs. And if the legislature and previous governors would not have had the foresight to do that, I can assure you we'd be in a lot more trouble than we are today. Fortunately, we've been fortunate to have some of the revenue that help offset that. But that's I don't know how to explain it any better than that, Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam
Chairman. Representative Pedersen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Short, you mentioned that there's a percentage that is that you can quantify for what is that optional service, and just does anybody with you have that number right now?
Madam Chairman, no, we don't have that with us today.
Madam Chairman, could we request just
we certainly can.
Piece of paper?
We'll get that to you.
Thank you.
Great. And we plan to do markup around the 20th of January. So
okay.
Have it by then. Maybe before we go into your supplemental requests and to continue this conversation, we know that there's substantial discussion going on about reorganization and changes. And I just certainly you're in transition with all of that, so it's probably not fair to ask you exactly what's going on there. But what have you done to start looking at how we, besides the points that you've brought up to us today, the 4 points here, various research that you've done, how you'll look at changing the face of Medicaid in a new reorganization if that were to occur?
You know, Madam Chairman, I've actually thought quite a bit about it, and I think that, you know, there's pros and cons of doing anything. I can give you some of my ideas and my thoughts. I think that the Medicaid program has always been a challenge for the Department of Health Director. The average lifespan of a Department of Health Director is 2.15 years.
And you exceeded that.
I have. I'm very proud of that.
But I also, of honor is due you.
But I also, I'm also, as I've told you before, a taxpayer of this state, and I care about how my money is spent, too. It's just, like I said, my analogy with the checkbook. It's very, very difficult. I think that, you know, I look at the Department of Health really as having four components. One is our facilities, which are direct patient care. That's 1,100 employees out in various areas of Wyoming. I think you know where they are. They mm-hmm. provide excellent clinical care to our folks. The other area is our divisions, which are really our public health components, very very important to try to get people healthier and to work on the prevention and health promotion side. The Wyoming Medicaid program, of course, which is two-thirds of our budget. And then we have a regulatory component in the department, too, through the Office of Healthcare Licensing and Surveys. So I kind of look at our department that way, and I think that, you know, if the department is split, I think what I would recommend that is carefully looked at is, first of all, does it make sense? You know, I think that requires some consideration. I'm not saying that it should or shouldn't be right now. I think that what I would hope that would be maintained is the integration of public health services and a separate Department of Medical Services if the legislature so chooses to do that, because prenatal care, which comes out of our Community and Public Health Division, and our public health nursing program, which comes out of that same division, which is part of the public health, is so important, I think, to getting people healthier. And I just don't want Medicaid to be sitting out here without having some incentives to utilize prevention and health promotion, because that's one of the areas that we've tried very hard to integrate within the department. I think that, you know, from an administrative standpoint, I think you need to be certain that you're not creating redundant HR, IT, fiscal services, because, I mean, that you need more positions to do that unless you utilized the same position. Those are some of the important things. And then, of course, I know I've read the Department of Medical Services bill, and there are a lot of statutory changes in other titles that need to be carefully looked at. Years ago, just for example, when this is relatively small compared to what we're talking about, but environmental health was taken out of the Department of Health and put in the Department of Ag, food safety, that sort of thing. We lost the ability for environmental health, and that is for, and it sounds kind of minor, but it's really not, to condemn houses and various types of environmental issues that come up across the state. And if we didn't have our large local health departments in Laramie County, Natrona, Sweetwater County, and Campbell County doing a lot of that for us, we wouldn't have a response. And our response is really not what it should be. So I guess my point is I think it's worth looking at, definitely. But I think I would be, you know, really cautious about the statutory changes, because it just needs to be done carefully, and I think with a lot of thought.
And, you know, Dr. Sherrard, we always consider ourselves so unique in Wyoming, but as you had stated early, everyone is having this issue with Medicaid, and I just wondered if in the realm of things, if you've contacted anyone or had an idea or a model of any state that's doing it more efficiently or has figured out the magic formula.
Before I came over here, I was reading an article from the state of Washington. They're looking at further provider rate cuts, and they're looking at cutting optional services. So they're addressing those two areas. You know, the administrative area has been cut, I think, quite a bit, partially because of hiring freezes and our folks are asked to do more. There might be some areas there. I think the eligibility system, Madam Chairman, is something we definitely need to focus in on, because of the 12-month eligibility issue, as well as, I think, improved automation. We do look at Medicaid fraud, because I know that comes up. We look at illegal alien payments. Actually, in the big picture, those are relatively small. Doesn't mean they're not important. But, in you know, as far as being able to make to be the most impactful, the other things that I talked about earlier, the provider rates, the eligibility, and the optional services is probably where most of the money is. But remember when you do this, that 88% of our budget goes for direct patient care, and it goes to providers. And then you have the list of those people. So it just has to be done carefully. That's all.
Thank you. Representative Edmonds? Oh, and I'm sorry. I'll get you next. Representative Esquivel, why don't you go?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Sherrard, with respect to your handout here and what you had said about the prenatal benefits, you had on that last line, I'm just looking at that, on citizen with medical emergencies, and the age group of 20 to 29, the females are at 146 and the males are at 7. So am I to assume that, and even in the next age range, it's really out of balance as well, that a lot of those cases are women coming into emergency rooms pregnant?
Madam Chairman, I'll let Terry
answer. Madam Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that would be correct.
Follow up, Madam Chairman? just for the committee's knowledge that that there is a program out there that covers these prenatal benefits, and it's at a 2/3 to 1/3 match. And to me, it makes more fiscal sense that we're getting prenatal benefits and having these women seen by doctors rather than coming into the emergency rooms when doctors have never seen these women before, and that the health of the baby be the number one concern of the state. And I got a letter here from CMS, and it goes into detail about that, and if the committee wants to look at cutting costs, because I know a lot of these births end up being premature births as well, and then we're paying outside the state of Wyoming a large amount of money in our newborn intensive care units as well. So I think when you look at those figures and you're looking at trying to save Medicaid costs in the long run, you know, that is a sensible option to do. And I know a lot of other states have been taking advantage of this program. Nebraska right now is considering it as well.
And Representative Esquivel, what is the name of the program?
It's the Unborn Child Option.
Okay. All right. And Dr. Sherrard, would you want to comment on
sure.
the...
Sure. Madam Chairman and Representative Esquivel, I'll have Terry comment more specifically, but we do look at these outlier children, if you will, that have severe medical problems and needs, and it's pretty mind-boggling what the costs are on some of these kids. Some of them have congenital cardiac problems. Others have congenital lung problems, lung disease. And, you know, it's hard to know what percentage of those kids, of those children's problems could have been prevented. But I think some of them could have been, either through genetic counseling or through, you know, proper prenatal care like you mentioned. I think that's very important. And I think we're trying to get to those people, but it continues to be a challenge. It's hard to get people to take care of themselves. But that is a strong focus, and we do have programs that address those. And, Terry, I don't know if you want to comment further on that, but what? Patty, would you like to, is it Madam Chairman, Patty Guzman and the SCHIP program could maybe speak to that?
Sure. Ms. Guzman, and if you want, you can just turn the mic on there at Senator Hastert's desk. You know, be a senator for a moment.
Yay. Let's vote now.
That's right. Madam Chairman, I'm Patty Guzman. I'm the manager of the CHIP program at the Department of Health. And now I get a nice comfy chair, too. So, Madam Chairman, can you, or Representative Esquivel, can you repeat your question so I can make sure that I answer it appropriately? Because I know that you and I have talked in the past about this option, and I know it's something that's available, and I'm not quite sure if it goes all the way into the Medicaid program, but I do know that it's an option for children or for women and children in CHIP, and it's basically an option where you can cover the child from conception on. So we would be able to cover an adult woman under the CHIP program, but because you'd be covering basically the fetus, and you'd be able to provide those types of services to that pregnant woman, and so that way, in hindsight, then you're covering the child. So can you repeat the question so I can make sure that I didn't miss something? Or?
Well, it was, Madam Chairman, proposed legislation last year, and I can't remember exactly what the House bill number was, 252, I think. And it did go into under the CHIP program, that unborn child option. And I think what it did was basically it looked at cost savings to states, because this was not just a problem in Wyoming, obviously. And CMS did hand out a flyer that has about a 12-page question and answer, which I could also provide a copy to all the members of the committee. And when I did talk with Ms. Guzman last year, I did get some figures on how much we were spending outside the state of Wyoming on newborn intensive care units, and at that point it was close to $20 million a year.
Right. go ahead. If you want to respond to that, what I would intercept there too, Dr. Sherrard, is just that we also don't have the medical facilities to provide some of those services for those cases, and maybe we need to bring that into the conversation.
Madam Chairman, that's exactly right. I mean, most of these high-intensity children go to Children's Hospital in Denver or Salt Lake City or Billings, Montana, Rapid City, some of them. So we don't have that ability in the state. And, you know, whether or not we should have that, I personally think it'd be very challenging, and I'm not sure particularly cost-effective to do that right now based on our population.
Representative Edmonds, and then Representative Wallace.
Well, Madam Chair, just because my question is, I think outside of this, I was going to go to something else, and I think Representative
Wallace.
Although I will make one comment that I would absolutely love to see a level three NICU, since my sister does that, and would be happy to come to this state and do it. So, just a shameless plug.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just want to make sure that I understand is what Representative Esquivel referring to as an option, is that an option under Medicaid as listed on page 5 that other states are employing but we are not?
Ms. Guzman, go ahead.
Madam Chairman, it's, and I cannot speak for Medicaid, and I think we would have to look into it, but I know it's an option under CHIP. And so it's separate from that. So it's basically a state plan amendment that we would have to submit to CMS and just indicate in there that we want to be able to cover children from conception on. And so basically in the CHIP program, they wouldn't look at it as if you're covering the mother, you're covering the child. And because in CHIP you can only cover children, then you would be covering the child from conception on. Because in our state plan right now and in our statute here in the state for CHIP, it basically says birth through the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So we would need to make that state plan amendment change. So it just basically for CHIP would be a request to CMS for that change and ask them to allow us to cover the children from conception on. But that is, like I said, specifically for the CHIP program.
Okay. Go ahead.
So, if I'm understanding this correctly, we have 45% of the births in Wyoming are covered under Medicaid, but Medicaid does not cover the prenatal care?
Ms. Green.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, Medicaid covers prenatal care for women who qualify for Medicaid. We do not cover prenatal care for illegal citizens. So these are the citizens that are presenting at the emergency room to deliver but have not been eligible for Medicaid prior to the delivery.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
We also, with the Medicaid to Pregnant Women program, it goes to 133%
yeah.
of the poverty level. And so,
say that name again.
With the Medicaid to Pregnant Women program that Terry was referring to that we do cover the prenatal services through, it only covers women up to 133% of the federal poverty level. And with this, what Representative Esquivel is talking about would also not only cover those who are not here legally, but it would also cover women or children at conception in women above 133% of the poverty level. So it would cover those children from when Medicaid's pregnant women coverage ends up to the CHIP coverage, which is at 200% of the poverty level.
Madam Chairman, and maybe what would help Representative Wallace, because I understand her concern here, maybe a handout that shows you where Medicaid picks up people, where it leaves off, and where SCHIP or KidCare picks up people, because they cover different,
yes.
a little bit different populations. Maybe that would help.
I think, Dr. Sherrard, that would help, and we have several new members,
yeah.
so it would be good
to
review that again. That would be great. Okay. Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to get back to, and this is another freshman question, the fiscal piece, and I know we've had conversations about that as a committee. Walk me through, if looking at Medicaid specifically, and I know that you're obligated to pay the funds, but looking at these shortfalls and hearing from the governor and when he was notified, walk me through how the fiscal piece works through Medicaid and up to you, Dr. Sherrard, and when you're notified, when you knew of the overages and that sort of thing.
Madam Chairman, we do have a sequence put together, and I will have Bob Peck, our Chief Financial Officer, go through that with you.
Yeah. Dr. Sherrard,
that's a great question.
Mr. Peck had been silent for too long.
Yeah, we
needed that opportunity.
We really want to bring him in here.
Yeah,
he's
we need to
got
bring
the
him
golden
in.
Voice.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman, we do have a handout.
Okay, sure.
This.
Let's go ahead and get that. Take a minute for everyone to get that.
Enough so I can take one. Okay.
Mr. Peck?
Madam Chair, thank you. I pondered for many days trying to figure out how to explain this, and I think I've come up with a way that I think is unfortunately very general, but I think it does indicate, number one, that, you know, it wasn't like we're sitting somewhere with our heads in the sand and not paying attention, but at the same time, I think it helps everybody understand that making changes to the Medicaid program is similar to avoiding an iceberg with a Titanic in some cases, because of the federal regs and everything else, it's difficult to turn that ship. You can't decide on one day I'm going to do this and then do it. And so I provided a pretty short history of how this whole process started. And this is provided to the committee. But basically, we knew when the unemployment was starting to rise in Wyoming, and we knew that the federal government was considering providing more funding to the state because of the potential impact on Medicaid. We actually met with the budget office and the governor and tried to figure out how best to project what that impact might be on Wyoming. I had prepared some projections, and my projections, to be honest with you, were, I provided them three projections. One would be there would be no growth. One projection was if there was 3% growth, and one projection was if there was 5% growth. We met and discussed that, and at that meeting we decided that, quote, to be safe, we probably should project an 8% growth. And so I did a projection on how that impact would be on the 2009-2010 biennium if we saw an 8% growth in Medicaid. And when I did the financial projection, it came up to $1,082,000,000 total for the biennium. Okay? When we looked at when fiscal year 2009 ended, our total cost for Medicaid for that year, for just fiscal year 2009, were $561 million. And our enrollment increase at that point in time was 9%. So we had projected 8%, and by June of 2009, we had already seen a 9% increase. It was at that point in time that the governor was doing his budget cuts, and we at that point in time determined to cut the Medicaid budget by about $51 million. So what we're going to do is we're going to reduce provider payments by 10%, and the effect of reducing those payments would be about $51 million. Okay? So if, in fact, so just to give you an idea, if we had continued on and our enrollment stayed at 9% and cost stayed the same, our actual expenditure for 2009-2010 would have been, taking that $561 million and doubling that for 2010, would have been $1,122 million, which was $40 million more than we originally projected. When we projected what our expenditure would be by implementing that 10% cut, we felt our projection at that time was that our 2010 expenditures would have been $510 million. That's the 561 less the $51 million reflective of our 10% cut. So if, in fact, our 2010 expenditures had been $510 million after that cut, then our total cost for the VAM would have been $1,071,000,000, which would have been less than the $1,082,000,000 that we had originally projected with an 8% increase. Okay? What happened in 2010 is that our expenditures, instead of going down 10%, actually went up $20 million. And the primary driver for that was that our actual enrollments in 2010 increased an additional 10% over and above what they were for 2009, which we mentioned earlier that our total increase in enrollments from June of 2008 through June of 2010 was 19.4%. So basically what, you know, the problem, you know, is that while we projected $510 million in cost in 2010 with a budget cut, our actual cost ended up being $581. So our actual total cost for the biennium ended up being $1,142 million, or approximately $60 million over the original estimate. Now, the good news is, if there isn't any good news, is that that $60 million increase, the feds paid for most of that either with the federal match and the ERA funds. So our net, our total net obligation now is approximately $21 million in general fund is required to close out the biennium. You know, Terry can speak to this probably better than I can, but I'm going to, you know, anytime we make a change to the Medicaid program, it's going to require a state plan amendment. For example, when we actually decided to make the budget cuts, it took us a while to get all of that approved by CMS before we could actually implement some of those cuts. Fortunately, Terry's group did a very good job in getting what she could change done soon, and then adjusting those rates for those other items that required CMS approval, did a good job in understanding what that would need to be to get that 10% cut in place. They did a great job in that. So what it meant was that even though it took us a while to get all the cuts implemented, we still saw the reduction in costs. And the way we look at that is the reduction in cost per recipient. So when you look at the people that receive services, the actual cost to provide that service in 2010 went down from what it was in 2009. Yes, 12. Yeah, and we're showing that it went down on average about a little over 12%. So the cuts were effective. So the point being is, if you know, it's a matter of when you, from my perspective and looking at the overall budget, the sensitive part is when do you have to make that decision to make further cuts, and then what areas do you have available to you? For example, if you're not in session, I can't cut optional services because that would require a statute change. You know, we could have cut provider payments further. The governor preferred that we not do that. But again, even if we decided to do that in December, okay, it would have taken several months before we had those state plan amendments. So now you're into, you know, probably the earliest you could implement them would be April, even if you decided in December that you need to make those cuts, further cuts. So it's really a challenge in the fact that understanding when you need what I call pull that trigger. And in our case, you know, I think you could say that, you know, we were hopeful that we would get through the biennium. It turned out we didn't, and that's our shortfall. You know, bad forecasting on my part, you know, I don't know. But the bottom line is, when you look at it from my perspective, is that it's still not a very large percentage when you look at the overall budget. And you're talking about $20 million of general fund out of a total budget of about, you know, $1.1 billion. So So that's as simply as I can make it.
Thank you, and I'm glad you brought this. Good anticipation. We're going to start with Senator Meyer, and then we have a few other committee questions here. So.
And you have to look at the results of those cuts. Is that you have some providers going bankrupt, other providers out there and in nursing homes that are starting to lose money and borrowing on their reserves or borrowing from a bank. And, you know, that's the reality that the cuts are making. And so we have some, some really serious discussions that we're going to have to make and have because there's not a lot we can do about the number of people who are eligible, especially in the older area of our demographics. And that is only going to get larger. And that's something that I think that we're going to have to be cognizant of. I think we're going to have some really good forecasting about what that's going to be. We know we're going to have more need for nursing homes, more need for Alzheimer's. Hopefully our residential treatment centers and our substance abuse efforts have been successful, and we may be able to find some benefits in that. But I think we're going to have a real good understanding on this committee about where all those things lie and how we can actually make the jigsaw puzzle fit. Because right now the pieces are not coming together. And so we've got a lot of heavy lifting in the next few days.
Thank you. I'm going to go with Representative Harshman and then Representative Edmonds, and we'll continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the 10% reduction, let me just find it in there. How much did you cut? I'm trying to find it.
Madam Chair and Representative Harshman, we cut $51 million.
$51 million. And most of that was provider reimbursements. I mean, that's how you could act quickly and do it. And you think you probably pounded those about as low as you can go. Is that, kind of the sense I'm getting?
Ms. Green?
Madam Chairman, I think that's a fair statement. Yes.
Well, I want to just ask about the optional service, because really you're talking about four areas, the provider rates, the optional services. And something caught my attention when you said you couldn't change those because we weren't in session. And then are there other states, though, that have given that authority, or can we do that? I don't know. Do other states say, hey, if in this situation, you know, the black swan deal, that you have that authority? Could you talk about that?
Ms. Green?
Madam Chairman, that's correct. There are states that are cutting optional services out of their budgets and out of their Medicaid programs. And you may have heard things like the state of Arizona cut transplants out of their Medicaid program. We added transplants in probably 5 or 6 years ago into the state of Wyoming for adults, and that is simply liver, kidney, and bone marrow, I think. So if we cut that, yes, it's something, but it's something very small to cut out of your budget. It's not going to amount to millions of dollars. It's something very small. And I would remind you that when that happened, we were unable to pay for a liver transplant for a young mother who passed away, and that's what prompted that legislation, and we added that in. So we go through those kinds of cycles all the time of somebody does without, so then we add it into Medicaid. So now we have it as an optional service, and over time that grows. There are states that are cutting out physical therapy, occupational therapy, things like that.
Madam Chair, my question specifically was, has there been states, or is it even legal, I don't know, that where we could say, hey, we give you this authority in the event of a budget shortfall to cut this amount? I mean, I know you said it's like 4% of the – it wasn't very much, but do states give that authority over to Bob Peck or a Director Sherrard?
Oh, dear.
That's what I'm – when we're out of session. I mean, really, do we give that authority to the director?
That's probably too much
Madam
power.
Madam Chairman, I am not familiar with that in any state, but we could certainly find out.
Yeah. I think that would be a great thing just to look into as to what kind of power you could be given while we're out of
session. Madam Director, I just make another comment, too. Yes. You know, one of the challenges we have, and I think I'm speaking for Dr. Sherrard here, but hopefully he'll forgive me. But, you know, there's a lot of things, discussions we'd like to have, you know, ongoing throughout the year. But, you know, some states have full-time legislators. So when they have a problem like this, they actually have the ability to do something in a very short time. Mm-hmm. Where if something happens for us in May, you know, we have to really, if it needs a statute change or, it needs some discussion, you know, we're oftentimes waiting until the session comes in. So we're at a little bit of a disadvantage of being more nimble than I think other states might be able to be. But I think the statute can read, you know, provided it's legal. I mean, the statute could say we give that authority to the governor to, you know, just like the legislature did in balancing the budget.
Right.
You know, you gave that authority to the governor to make changes as necessary to balance the budget. I think you could probably do something in that regard.
Madam Chairman, yeah. If I could just make one other comment, too, and I think it's a good question, Representative Harshman. When we did our budget cuts, of course, that I just want everybody to be clear, that did include the providers who provide optional services. So they were also cut. I think what we might be talking about here is the absolute elimination of some of those services, if I'm reading the question correctly.
And we all know that's the big question, whether we have the will or the desire to do that. But it was more about giving the executive some power in our absence, as this, we're one of the last few part-time legislatures.
And Madam Chairman, Representative Harshman, because I went through these 10% cuts, what would happen in reality is you would be hearing a lot of concern from your constituents.
Sure.
And then what happens, of course, is some of those things are put back in, because basically you'd probably be putting some people out of business. And that's the reality of it.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. This is another freshman question. Can you just very quickly, Mr. Peck, walk me through how monthly are you tracking when the service is provided, how quickly the claim is paid, and how you stay on track of that, and perhaps if there's, you know, if we do a system to help upgrade you, if there's better ways that we could be doing that to help you. And I know on the front end you don't have the ability to see this eligibility piece, which I think probably hampers. But if you could just walk me through the tracking of claims.
Mr. Peck.
Madam Chair and Representative Edmonds, Terry handles all the group handles all the payments. I don't do the payments. I do monitor the budget, and I can tell you that we have met regularly, monthly, to go over the actual Medicaid process. You know, and how our expenditures are going, what they're tracking, try to identify areas where we see those expenditures increasing, and try to identify are there things that we can do about that. Regarding the actual payments, I think Terry can tell you that we're one of the better states in the country as far as payment.
Ms. Green.
Madam Chairman, Representative Edmonds, first of all, there are two separate systems. We have a fiscal agent payment system, and then we have the eligibility system that is housed in the Department of Family Services. So they're two completely separate systems. They do interface with each other, and that's how we get the eligibility feed from the Department of Family Services. In the payment system, we turn around Medicaid payments at about probably 98% to 99%. We turn them around. If it's a clean claim, meaning there's no problem with the claim, the provider submitted it correctly, we turn those around within a week. So we have, by rule, 30 days to turn that payment around on a clean claim, and by our contract with our fiscal agent, but we actually turn those around rather quickly.
Senator Meyer.
I'm trying to get the budgetary effect of options. Would that be found on page 7 as Medicaid expenditures as percentage of total cost? Is that others, the 1%? Is that the options, or is it in another pie chart somewhere that I'm not aware of right now?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, no. That what that chart shows, if you're looking at 3.10 on page 7?
Yes.
Okay. That just simply speaks to what amount of percentage, what percentage of our total expenditures each of those eligibility group comprises or expends. So the children only use 28% of the expenditures in the program.
Madam Chairman.
Pregnant women, 7%.
Madam Chairman,
Senator Meyer.
Do we have a pie chart that would illustrate page 5 as far as the optional services on a dollar and percentage basis compared to the total in the mandatory services?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, that was requested here, and we will provide that to the committee.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The brainiacs that sit behind us here told me that that number is 4% of optional services, 4% of the pie.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, 4% of the optional. Yeah, of all the provisions, only 4% is optional. Okay. Yeah, we didn't find the magic bullet. All right. Dr. Sherrard, committee, I would like to see us wrap this up by 6 o'clock. So maybe if you're okay with the handouts and the questions that have been now, let's go ahead and work the budget, and if you'd like to present the supplemental requests. Thank you. And thank you for your indulgence on the questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first request in the Department of Health's budget is on page 9 of our budget document.
Does everyone have their budget document in front of them?
And that relates to the tax refund program for the elderly and disabled. A couple years ago, the legislature increased not only the income limits for people to qualify for that program, but also the amount of money that we, maximum money we could pay out to both married and single applicants. This request, I'm happy to say we can actually reduce based upon our current, what we're seeing in our current program. It's nice to start off our budget request with a reduction.
I know, I can't wait to hear the rest. Okay, continue.
We're almost through with the 2010 application period, and we'll have the rest of the checks hopefully out by the end of this month. Most of the checks were sent out in December, so we have some good data. Basically, based upon what we see in the program right now and leaving some money for potential increase for this next period in applicants, we did see a slight increase in applicants this year over last year, but less than what we had anticipated. We can reduce that exception request by $454,397, or the total request being $600,000. The governor did recommend approval of this request.
Okay. Okay. I think you can continue.
Thank you. The next request is on page 13. This relates to the Children's Health Insurance Program, what we call SCHIP. Basically, the reason for this request is the new CHIPR law required SCHIP to implement a mental health parity, a prospective payment system for federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics, medically necessary orthodontics, and medically necessary dental benefits. So we've had to increase our benefit package in this area, which increased our premium. So the actual request here is a total of $1,741,000. $609,000 of that is general fund. The rest is federal funds. We get a 65% federal match on our SCHIP program. The governor did recommend approval of that request.
Any questions?
The second request is on page 14, and that's a quality reporting and external quality review. Again, the CHIPRA Act that was passed in 2009 requires each state CHIP program that contracts with a managed care organization, which in our case is Blue Cross Blue Shield, to develop a quality assessment and improvement strategy program. And we estimate the cost of that to be about $400,000, $140,000 general fund, $260,000 federal fund, and that request was approved by the governor, or recommended by the governor, I should say.
Continue.
Moving on, if you want to skip page 17, we can. in order to get out of here by 6.
Yeah, right.
Madam Chair, our next request is on page 17, and that's the Medicaid request. And, I think it might be helpful to the committee to try to figure out exactly what we were trying to do here. I actually met with both the budget office and the LSO to try to determine how we wanted to do this. And originally the direction was that we wanted to the actual request to be our best guess is what we think will happen in 11-12, but then be also include a fallback in case our request the actual expenditures exceeded what we thought our best estimate was. So we went through a process, and I'll quickly go through this. And I'll try to do it quickly. When we originally prepared our request, keep in mind that we had to submit our request in August of 2010. At that time, we only had data through June of 2010. And so what we did was we actually looked back as I mentioned, how those enrollments were increasing and we were seeing comparable increases in number of people that were actually submitting claims each month. We went back, and it appeared that starting in September of 2009, we really started seeing a little more flattening of those people that were submitting claims. So we took those 10 months of expenditures and projected them over the for 24 months to get to our original request. By the time the governor had a chance to review our request, we actually had data through, I believe, September at that point in time. And what we found was that actually on a month-to-month basis for just the first 3 months of this biennium, our costs were actually averaging about 2.8% more than the same month the previous year. So what that allowed the governor to do was actually reduce that request. So the governor's adjustment to our request really reflects the data that we had through September of 2010. So you will see that the governor did recommend that our request be reduced from $192 million in change down to $171 million change, or $21 million, basically, reduction in his recommendation, which reduced the general fund requirement from $76,723,000 down to $66,231,000.
Senator Meyer?
Madam Chairman, thank you. Bob, now that he did that in October, you had it through September. Today's January. Do you have it at least through November, those numbers now?
Madam Chair and Senator Meyer, actually we have tracked, we have actually through December actual expenditures. And what we're seeing is while October we had a pretty significant increase in our costs, actually November and December we've seen pretty significant decreases in our costs when you compare year over year. Personally, I'm a little hesitant at this point in time to project the rest of the biennium based upon what happened last biennium. To assume that those reduction in costs, that we'll see that as a pattern for the rest of this biennium. But as we get more information, you know, if I see 4 more months of similar, then I would then be able to say that probably we're going to be in better shape than we thought.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Platern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peck, now that you have that general fund request went to $66,231,000 with the governor's recommendation with the extra month of data, so would the federal funds in the R just proportionally go down the same?
Mr. Peck.
Madam Chair and Senator Von Platern, the federal request would go down, but not the ERA funds, because right now the ERA funds are actually based upon still an increase in expenditures. So we get a flat percentage on our expenditures of the ERA funds. So we still expect to collect that $19,600,000 additional to what was already in our standard budget.
And Mr. Peck, was that based on the 6% from the ERA funds?
Madam Chair, that is actually based upon the extension of the ERA funds from December of 2010 was the original expiration date, and they extended it through June 30th of 2011, but they're also phasing it down. And if you look at this document that we provided when we were talking about the governor, the actual rates for ERA are actually included on that document if you really want to look specifically how they've changed. So really that request, the $19,600,000 of ERA funds, is a result of the extension of the program by the federal government.
Continue.
Thank you. Follow up on that. So the 19.6, where is that? If that doesn't change, it's a lump sum amount of money. Is it going to be placed somewhere else? I don't know what effect it would have, because you're not going to spend it for this match. So is it moved somewhere else?
Mr. Peck?
Madam Chair and Senator Von Platern, actually the way that this budget is prepared, we actually have an accounting system that we use for ERA funds, and what we have to do is we actually have to move it. They're captured in a separate fund in the state auditor's office, so we actually have to move expenditures out of the Medicaid program, Fund 001, which is the general fund, into the special fund for ERA. And then we then draw down the funds that we're entitled to based upon that. I know that's might be a little confusing, because sometimes I don't understand it myself, to be honest with you. Right.
All right. Continue.
Okay. Madam Chair, the next request was on page 22. Oh, I need to finish that request. Yes. There was a big portion of this that I skipped over that I shouldn't do, Madam Chair. The governor also recommended that we put $25 million of additional general fund in the auditor's office general fund Medicaid account just to cover any potential increase in cost over and above what we've projected. And we already have $25 million in that account from the previous budget, so that would bring us to a total of $50 million. Okay, and the second thing that the governor recommended is that we need to be mindful that for Medicaid, we expect, we're getting in this biennium, we should get around $49 million of ERA funds. Come the next biennium, 13-14, those funds will no longer be available. So I think what the governor wanted to do is for the committee to be mindful that we might want to put a placeholder there. As you work up your goldenrod to make sure that we don't get ourselves in a bind when those ERA funds go away.
Right. Yeah, I remember these discussions from the original inception of ERA funds.
It's a very important discussion for your committee, Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Now, Bob, I guess refresh my memory as far as if we continue to have less drawdown on the Medicaid and we have a balance in there, which would be almost historical. That would just be regular reversions that would go back to the general fund, or are you guys, do those go anyplace else?
Madam Chair and Senator Meyer, I did have a deal with Governor Friedenthal that I would get a commission on any savings.
Okay.
Seriously, if in fact we fund the budget as is
and our actual expenditures end up less than that, the general fund portion of those savings would then normally would revert into the general fund at the end of the biennium, which I think is your question.
Okay. I'm getting the nod from the other folks, too, that that's correct. Okay.
Okay.
Continue.
It's always good to get nod. You know, when Mrs. Green used to sit back here and I had to talk for her, it was never a nod. Okay. Madam Chair, the next request is on page 22.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for this request was originally it was a placeholder. Back in the summer of 2010, we were notified by CMS that they would no longer pay for court-ordered placements if the court ordered that child to a specific facility. So the risk was that in our current system, and I'm not a legal expert, I don't pretend to be, is that most of our court orders did actually specify the order, the place where that child would receive services. So that was going to present a problem. So the risk was that we would no longer get the federal match for the cost incurred by those children. So this request was a placeholder at that time. The governor denied the request, and he's saying that if these expenditures actually do materialize, that we should probably use the budget reserve to cover those. The good news is that we're 6 months into the biennium right now, and we haven't seen a lot of those general fund-only costs. We're actually only paid out only $40,000. What we don't know is there could be some children that we're paying for through the normal Medicaid system that could have a court order that includes that specific facility. And but we're actually getting that documentation from DFS because they actually control the court orders. So we're going to be able to review that data and probably hopefully get you something to let us know whether that's a real risk or not.
Before next Thursday, do you think, or during the session?
During the session, for sure, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm not sure we're going to be able to get it by next Thursday, but we'll do our best.
Okay, right. I was thinking in case of markup, if we needed to.
Exactly. If we will do our best to get the information because we want you to have all the information you need.
Okay, good. Continue.
Okay. Next request is on page 24. This request deals with our adult comprehensive waiver services. A couple years ago, the bill was passed that created a process whereby we're going to charge or we're going to pay a fee for the services provided in our adult waivers. This request reflects the increase, our expected increase in actual units of service that we're going to see in this biennium. And we have Chris Newman here, who's the administrator of the Developmental Disability Division here, if you want further explanation on that.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Peck. And typically, committee, we usually have an extensive conversation on developmental disabilities and the waivers. And I'm not certain on how much time we have here, but I would like Ms. Newman to maybe just give us an overview and address this issue to help the committee understand the issue. And do we have the mobile? Oh, okay. We'll just change chairs and have her sit with Ms. Green for a moment. Thank you, Ms. Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like to explain is that as Mr. Peck explained, in July 1st of 2008, we started implementing a new standardized rate system for two services on our home and community-based waivers. That was residential rehabilitation and day rehabilitation. Until that time, every person on the waiver did have a individual budget that they had to remain within, but they could negotiate the rates for those two services with the provider. So there was not a standard rate for those two services. As you can imagine, our Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services had concerns with that structure and said we needed to have a standardized rate for all of our services that was based on acceptable methodology. We worked with the Select Committee on Developmental and Intellectual Programs and a consultant and a provider advisory group to establish those rates based on provider costs, on wages that they were paying employees, on their overhead, et cetera. In determining what those rates were going to be, we looked at claims data from several years before that time period. And what we weren't aware of is that there were some providers, not all, but some providers, because they could negotiate the rate, and I will give you an example. For residential habilitation, that is a daily rate, and most of the people receiving that service need it year-round. However, they do go home sometimes to visit family. They go on vacation, or they may go in the hospital, and the provider does not get paid for those days. When we allowed negotiated rates, the providers would be conservative about how many units they would need for that service. So instead of saying 365, they may put, I need 350 days of that service, and I will charge a little bit higher rate, and that way I'll be sure to cover my cost, and if the person does leave the service during that time period, I won't lose that money. When we implemented the new rates, we were not aware that how much that was occurring with some providers. And after we received the appropriation, it was $7.8 million to implement new rates, and we were starting that implementation process, some providers informed us, well, I'm going to need more units then for that service because now I have a standardized daily rate for residential habilitation. You based the money on 350 days. However, in reality, this person is usually here 360 days, so I'm 10 days short. The allocation we got or the appropriation from the legislature did not factor that in. We were not aware of it until after that process was completed. And so from that point till now, we have not been able to fund those additional units. And so that would, for both our adult developmental disabilities waiver and our acquired brain injury waiver, that's what these requests are asking for. So it's services that are now being provided. It's not new service, but it's to compensate those providers for those days that they are not being compensated given the standardized rate.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Newman? And Senator Hastert, did you have any comments? You did sit on the select committee for this. Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. I think we can continue. Thank you, Ms. Newman. That was easy this time around, but you never know. There could be a callback.
Madam Chair, the governor did recommend this request primarily because we'd actually surveyed to get a pretty good, felt like a pretty reasonable number for what units really needed to be supplied.
Right. Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next request is on page 27. This is basically the same request for the ABI program. Again, it's those units that they serve that were not previously included in the funding.
Mr. Peck, I'm assuming from the select committee work activity that there's probably a handout or a comparison that might be a little more detailed that maybe we could get for the committee to review over the next week. Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Peck.
Sure. Madam Chair, the governor, again, did recommend this request as well. And it was only for, pull the number back here before I get too far ahead of myself, is $153,000, basically. Madam Chair, the next request is on page 31. This is a request for our emergency medical services office. And basically this request is to support their travel, their instructor payments, and their educational materials for the trainings they do around the state for EMS providers. This request is for $82,225. And the reason for this request is that we lost some federal funding that used to pay for these expenditures, and we feel like this is a pretty important function for our state, and the governor did recommend that we approve this.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to stay on this part of the budget for just a minute further. Some things have come to light since December about some funding issues in this in emergency medical service, and perhaps our new director of the EMS could step up to the mic and shine a light on that for us.
And for the record, please state your name.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. My name is Andy Gienapp. I'm the new administrator for the Office of EMS, and extend my thanks to you and the committee for allowing me to speak before you today. And if I might, I would just like to recognize Ms. Paula Fagnan, who is the current president of the Wyoming Association of Pre-Hospital Providers, Mr. John Sade, who's also in attendance, he's the current president of the Wyoming Ambulance and EMS Association, and Chief Lyle Armstrong, who is the president of the Wyoming Fire Chiefs Association. All of them have a vested interest in our EMS, and I thank them for attending today. Yeah. The appropriations, the funding issue that Representative Stewart raises were appropriations of about $766,000 that were appropriated in 2008. They were geared towards four specific categories to establish stipends with our physician medical directors to support EMT classes done throughout the state, to provide stipends to the ambulance services to help defray their costs in conducting the training, and also to offer grants and support to conferences that were done throughout the state. In the transition between Jim Mayberry, who was the last my predecessor who held the position before I did, he retired, and Susan Wilson was serving as interim. The request that the appropriations be extended for the next biennium didn't get made. So we relied heavily on those funds, and we put them to good use while we had them. And we're here to ask that that we get that same money appropriated back for this next year.
Representative Stewart, did you have further comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And most of you probably have seen I put a packet of material in your box a day or two ago to explain this funding, and also with a copy of the session laws that showed the initial appropriation. And of course, at this time, it doesn't seem fair to ask for the whole appropriation. We're going to, during markup, I will probably ask to amend this budget to add in $380,000, half of the initial appropriation, to get them through this second half of the biennium. And then, Madam Chair, they would come back in the normal budget process and request an exception request to continue the funding into the next biennium. Madam Chair, merely now to shine a bright light on this need that just we became aware of in December, that unfortunately we find out that these things happen. It just fell through the cracks. An exception request was not made through the normal budget process, through the situation that was outlined by Andy.
And Madam Chairman, that was our oversight. And, you know, the legislature has been very generous a few years ago in the EMS program, and I think everyone in here is aware that approximately 85% of our EMS folks are volunteers out there. And it is a system that with your help, definitely improve the overall status of the system in Wyoming. So,
committee, are there any other questions of Mr. DeMatt?
With respect to those, before we provide that appropriation, is it something that counties were providing this education and getting the work done? What happened before, and what's happening now?
Madam Chairman, Senator, I'm sorry, I don't think I understood your question.
Well, as I understood, the
dollars were for training and for classes. Is that right?
Madam Chairman and Senator Nicholas, yes, that is correct. There was a large portion of that is allocated towards those efforts, yes.
But I assume that what my question was is before we offered the grants a couple of years, they were new grants, were the counties then paying for those services, and now that the state funds are not there, is it the training stop or the counties stepped up to pick up the training?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, a lot of that was obviously well before I came in here, but I would suspect that the training was occurring, but what the appropriations that were allocated in 2008 allowed us to do was to accelerate to ramp up the number of classes that were done. And also, as I understand it, about 408,000 of the appropriations in 2008 were set aside to create the contracts with the physician medical directors. And as that was a brand new appropriation at that point.
And Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, on the medical director appropriation, one of the things that has been a consistent problem for many years is incentivizing the medical directors to be more involved. They're a critical component of the system, and this allowed us to provide them some stipends, and we hold them accountable for helping oversee those individual programs around the state.
Dr. Sherrard, was there an incident that actually shed light on this issue? Because if you were having a contract with physicians and providing those funds, did there become a time when all of a sudden they were not getting their reimbursement?
Madam Chairman, what we were seeing at the time, and I hope this answers your question, is a real lack of interest out there from some physicians in certain communities, or physicians would leave a community and leave the EMS service out there without a medical director. And there, when I was in Wheatland, my partner was the medical director, and it takes a lot of time. And I know he spent a lot of his time on the projects. And the rationale was to improve physician oversight, to improve patient care on ambulance runs, and to be more actively involved and to be there to ensure accountability and to ensure that the people are well-trained and properly licensed and actually know what they're doing out there. And I think it's been very helpful.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, we can continue. Thank you, Mr. DeMatt.
Thanks, Andy.
Madam Chair, the next request is on page 35. This is for our new worksite wellness project. In the 09-010 biennium, we actually began to fund this project. There was a request that was approved. It was for the last year of the biennium. And when the standard budget was created for 11-12, that amount was not biennialized. So basically what we're doing here is requesting the second year of that funding. 1 year was included in our standard budget. This is the second year. Dr. Sherrard may want to speak to this program and some of the benefits this program provides to the state.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, this is part, basically this is one of our wellness initiatives, and we have contracted with an outside contractor who travels around the state, meets with businesses who are interested in implementing a worksite wellness program. Been very well received. Just some of the folks that have been involved in this are the City of Lander, City of Torrington, City of Gillette, First Education Savings in Jackson, and the list goes on and on. But, I think one of our strategies to get people healthier is to put funding into a worksite wellness program. For every $3 or for every $1 you put in prevention, you get $3 back. And, I think that it's a relatively small, it's a lot of money, but it's still a relatively small amount to put into, I think, an initiative that shows definite merit and has been well received by a lot of the businesses across the state.
Senator Meyer.
Dr. Sherrard, this is out of the tobacco settlement funds. if I recall, those funds are kind of on a downward glide path. I was just wondering whether that's have you been kind of keeping track of that? Are we at risk of overspending that fund, or what's our balance in it?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, I'll turn that over to Bob. I think he's got some information on the tobacco settlement account.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, you're exactly right. Our payment in April of 2010 was a little over $1 million less than it was the previous year. However, right now with the appropriation that we have, I believe a couple things have happened. Number one, the permanent fund has increased, so we also are getting a larger investment of income out of the interest on the or investment of the permanent fund, and I think that's offset a little bit of that, but we are getting to the point. I'm a little nervous that if our next check is less, and Madam Chair, do you want to explain how what happens with that check? The Master Settlement Agreement was entered into, I think, in 1999, but however, the provision does allow the manufacturers that agreed to be part of that settlement are paying in to this account, and those are the monies that are distributed each year to the states. However, they were given the ability in that process to protest payments. And so, as best I can tell in getting information from the Attorney General, it looks like what happened this past year was that the manufacturers protested a larger portion of the payment than they did in previous years. What that means is we could get our regular payment this coming April. I just don't know. But that was the reason for the reduction in the check. But right now, I do anticipate to get, in this biennium, about $40 million of tobacco settlement payments from the manufacturers. And then we're earning, last year we earned about $5.8 million on our investment account. I'm not sure it's going to be that much this year and next year, but I'm projecting somewhere between $48 million and $50 million would be actual income that could be available through the tobacco settlement funding. The other thing you have to keep in mind is that right now our appropriation is around $48 million, maybe a little bit more than that, but not all the monies are spent every biennium. For example, one of the programs that's supported by the Tobacco Settlement Fund is probation services, which really pays for the probation officers for the Department of Family Services. And oftentimes due to because it's 100 series, you know, there are vacant positions for some period of time. So there is a portion of that reverts that can cover us in case, you know, it gets a little close to being the income gets a little close to being what the appropriation is. I think that the fund can handle the $200,000. And Madam Chair, I do plan on giving you a workup for your workup.
Right, and also
an account of the tobacco settlement funds and my best projection as to what might be available.
I would appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Peck. Ms. Senator Meyer.
Madam Chairman, Bob, because it's 100 series funds, do those revert to the general fund then, and they don't go back to the tobacco settlement thing? So you,
Madam Chair, actually, the way the statute is written, that any appropriation to using tobacco settlement funds actually reverts to the permanent fund. So that's why the balance in the permanent fund has increased over the years. I think it started out with about around $40 million or something like that, and it's now over $60
million. Okay. Good. All right. Continue.
Before we go to the 901 series, is that met the goal?
Mr. Peck?
The 901 series, that's consulting services. Senator Nichols, I'm not sure I understand exactly. Madam Chairman, if this is included, if this is approved and included in our budget, then the standard budget would be increased from $200,000 a biennium to $400,000 a biennium.
One time we put it in 902, or what do we do? 903. 903 would be
one time.
901 is standard.
Thank you. Yes, sir. The governor did approve this request. Moving on. Madam Chair, the next request is on page 41. This is the, there are two, actually it's on 40. The first request that you'll see on page 40 is actually to make a correction in the fund account. When the budget was approved for 11-12, when LSO sent that the budget recommendation to the SAO, they sent the wrong fund identifier. And all this section request does is change the fund from permanent land fund to a TNA revenue code fund. So it's just a fund change, no additional expense. The next request is on page 41. This is the request that we bring you every session related to the preschool program. By statute, we're required to take a child camp account on November 1st of every year and calculate how the appropriation needs to be adjusted related to that account. We took the child count at the original child count that was reported was 4,038 children in the program on November 1st of 2010, which would result in, based upon the $8,743 statutory payment for each of those children would indicate a request of $1,967,175. However, I can reduce this request.
This is good news, Mr. Peck.
We actually did get a correction from one of our providers, so the actual head count was actually only 3,992 children, which means we can reduce the request by $402,178, meaning that the actual request is now we're recommended to be $1,564,997, and the governor did approve this request.
Nope. Seeing no questions, continue.
Hey, Madam Chair, the next request is on page 44.
Before you go there, just if you remind me, the going back to the eligibility for these services, and we're seeing such dramatic numbers increase. What is the with respect to the numbers? Describe a little bit about the eligibility for these services and how it is that you see these kind of volumes go up in a year.
Madam Chair and Senator Nichols, I'd like to turn that over to Mrs. Newman, who manages this program.
We're on 42 and 43.
Yeah. Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, the preschool program has a very extensive child find requirement that states are required to report to get funds to show that they're actively assessing and getting kids in service as quickly as possible from birth to age three so they can hopefully address those delays that are identified quickly and get them up to the age-appropriate level of where they should be. I will tell you that the initial count, the increase, we were surprised at ourselves a little bit. It has been reduced, as Mr. Peck described, due to an accounting error in one of our regions. And we would anticipate, I think, over upcoming years that does start to level off. The eligibility for the preschool services is much broader than for the home and community-based waivers that we administer as well, because the idea of these services is to identify delays, for example, in speech, language, some therapy needs, development needs that can, when addressed very early on and aggressively, can result hopefully in that child functioning at a level more appropriate to their age, and hopefully either need minimal special ed services when they get to school or less intensive than if those services weren't provided.
If the legislator want to make a more restrictive and to a narrower group of people, is that something we have the prerogative to do, or is you're either in the program or out of the program?
Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, there is some flexibility in the eligibility that different states could choose to do as far as the birth to three. So there is a little bit of flexibility there. In the 3 to 5, which is the Part B, which is actually the 3 to 18 or 3 to 21 that is the special ed for the schools, that's, I think, not is more limited. It's not as flexible. But we could provide you with information on current eligibility and then what that range is if you would like.
I'd like to see that data with respect to what the eligibility is, what our prerogative is, and maybe give us a class of various classes so we'd know what the financial impact is. To follow up on that, with respect to the eligibility that is, does our statute specify that we're going to give the full range of services, or does that just simply default it to the department to make that decision?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, the way our system is set up in Wyoming, once the child is determined to be eligible for services in the system, they are supposed to get the services that are needed based on their assessments. So it's individualized, and through those assessments, if they need, for example, speech, some therapies, and other services such as that, that is a service that that center is supposed to provide to them. So it's not that there's a specific array of services that are mandated for each child. It's based on the individual assessments, and then the preschool delivers those services to that child based on that child's plan.
So with respect to this program, we've opted in, and we've never described whether we're going to – we have the authority to limit services. We've not chosen to do that, so the broadest range has been offered. Or maybe that's not stated correctly.
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, I would not frame it that way. I would prefer to bring that information back to you because I don't believe we have the broadest services or the broadest eligibility. I think, what I can do is go back and gather that information in a document for you.
You might point out to us then when you provide that data whether or not the scope of services has been determined by the department without statute, and or whether the statute actually has defined what the scopes that we're providing so that we just know how we got here.
Senator Meyer.
Bob, I want to make sure I got the right numbers here. We're at $1,967,175. I thought there was a lower number than that.
There is. Mr. Peck, you want
Madam
to
Chair and Senator Meyer, the adjusted number is $1,564,997.
997. Madam Chairman and Bob, this is on page 43 that I would find that last number. Am I in the right spot?
If you start on page 41, Senator Meyer.
Right, but it tracks down to the one. Because on my page 43 and on my page 42 and
right.
Page 41, I've got the 1967. I don't have the 1564,997 anywhere.
It's a correction.
Okay, it's a correction. All right, so we'll have to make that amendment, right?
Correct.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Mr. Peck, continue.
Madam Chair, our next to last request, I always like to let you know about that, is actually on page 44.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's another fund change. We're just changing the funding from a permanent land fund account revenue two different. It was actually the funding was put in the wrong permanent land account, and we're just moving it from one to the other. No additional appropriation required.
Okay. Continue.
Madam Chair, our last request. Madam Chair, and that is on page 49. This relates to the Veterans Home of Wyoming. Madam Chair, the VA has notified the Veterans Home that they are going to be required to provide primary care to their residents going forward. In the past, and actually we've had a break here because according to the feds, we always should have been providing primary care. But the good news here is that the feds are actually going to increase their monthly per diem, or their per diem, for each resident to cover these costs.
The residents of the Veterans Home are currently being provided primary care at the Veterans Hospital in Sheridan. And we have met with them, and they have initially told us that they should be able to provide these services under contract for $90,000. So basically what happens is, and this is a little tricky, and just to make sure everybody understands, the Veterans Home is actually funded in the budget 100% general fund. However, we collect up to 75% of the operating cost from either the VA or the residents themselves. So actually the only the general fund, net general fund obligation is only 25% of the actual cost. What happens is that when we collect those funds, we actually deposit them directly back into the general fund. So I think it's helpful to understand that. So what, even though we have to increase our general fund appropriation by $90,000, we will be collecting that amount of money from the VA, and it will be deposited back into our general fund.
Okay.
And the governor did recommend approval of that request.
Okay. Any other questions? Are you okay on that, Phil?
Just clarify, the 6.8, it just comes – shows up in the form of reversions, or is it factored into the goldenrod before?
Let me see where I am.
Mr.
Madam Chair and Senator Nicholas, the 6.8, I'm not sure where that shows up. Probably Mr. Mike can probably tell you how that shows up on the goldenrod.
Mr. Mai.
Sorry, Mr.
The
Chairman,
Bill
I wasn't tracking.
Special account.
We're, Mr. Mai, we're on page 52.
So the discussion was what happens to those, were those dollars are profiled in all revenues naturally, or whether they show up as reversions, or...
That was good. You woke them all up.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, it does get reimbursed into the general fund.
So that would be actually factored in our goldenrod as we sit here.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Peck, that does take us through the supplemental request, Dr. Sherrard, and... are there any other questions of the committee before we release the Department of Health?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was wondering if the Department of Health could pick up the pieces that I missed when I was in the Rules Committee. I'm just kidding.
you can arrange that, Senator Hastert, but we're leaving here.
No, actually, this. Madam Chairman, I didn't know if this was covered, but I am very interested in the drug donation program, the status of that, and the getting, you know, what the health of that program is, and the need for, or what we would do to enhance that program.
Senator Hester, you're very lucky because that's one of the only topics we didn't cover. So, Dr. Sherrard, if you
Madam
can
Madam Chairman,
give us an update,
Roxanne Holmar's here, and I'll have her explain it. I might add, I truly think this is one of the most successful programs that we have implemented. It's been amazing.
Roxanne, if you'll identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Roxanne Holmar, I'm the state pharmacist with the Department of Health. And I can give a, I'll give an update on just a few figures with the medication donation program. I agree with Dr. Sherrard. I think this has been a exciting and really positive program. I'll give you some differences just from 2008 to our 2010 figures that are updated through December of 2010. When this program initially started in 2008, we had 1,378 pounds of medication donated. These are medications that would have otherwise been destroyed. The most of these medications come from institutions. They have to be bubble packed. And again, so nursing homes, assisted living facility centers, that type of thing. Again, when the patient leaves, they get a medication change, et cetera. Those medications cannot be returned. They would have otherwise been destroyed. Once donated to the program in 2008, they were able to fill 2,110 prescriptions from those donated medications. Those are for clients who don't have insurance, so they're uninsured or underinsured, and otherwise may have shown up at the ER looking, you know, for some help with their prescription, gone without till they were sicker, et cetera. They were able to get those medications for free, and that value was $252,891 in retail value of medications. In 2010, just a couple years later, there have been almost 5,000 pounds of medications donated this last year. That equated to 8,439 prescriptions that were filled with this free medication. And in retail value for those medications, it was $790,000. So a good return on investment for that program.
Roxanne, can you tell us how far-reaching that is around the state of Wyoming, mm-hmm. Who you're servicing with that?
Madam Chair, I sure can. I think, honestly, we've probably hit the tip of the iceberg on this program because most of this service is provided in Laramie County. The reason for that is that the groups that work with the low-income, uninsured folks in this county really came together initially, and, for example, the hospital provided free space. The Laramie County Community Partnership came up with some funding to help run the program in the county, and some other grants through United Way, that type of thing. We, through your help at the legislature, were able to provide the staff, because what they came back to us and said was, we can't pay a pharmacist to dispense these meds. In this last year, they were able to come back, these community partners, and said, you know what, we can fund the pharmacist position, which is what we set out to say. This isn't going to be long-term. You guys are going to have to come up with a solution eventually, because we really need to serve the entire state as best we can. So the Community Health and Wellness Center here in Cheyenne is now offering and providing free space to the centralized pharmacy. And the county is providing the funding for that pharmacy. And our staff is essentially acting more as the warehouser, accepting the donations, and they will just be moving into their space over at the Community Health and Wellness Center at the end of this month at a really good rate of rent for like $1 a square foot. They're giving us a really good deal. So the focus on that part-time pharmacist and pharmacy tech that are our staff for that program are going to be they're located close to the centralized pharmacy, so they'll be able to work with them really well here in Cheyenne, but also to focus on getting more donations out across the state, because we do have a number of free clinics across the state that we provide stuff to, but we can do more with that.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, thank you. Is it correct that we're spending at the cost to the state, right, or the cost for the program for the pharmacists, and is it like $177,000? And what would the cost be to add an additional site?
Madam Chair and Senator Hastert, it would probably come down to, we'd have to look at which community would be ready for that type of thing. Two-part question. Your initial question was, is it about $177,000? That's a year. That's not a biennial figure, but that's for mostly the salary, the benefits for the staff, some IT requirements, some rent, that type of thing, but it's mostly staff costs. Most of those places will tell you their problem is in hiring a pharmacist to dispense it back out, and that's why they are only able to sort of, in a limited capacity, accept meds and dispense them back out to those clients in need in their communities. So it would probably be at least a pharmacist, not necessarily a full-time pharmacist, but at least a part-time pharmacist in a particular community would assist them greatly. We haven't gone beyond any particular discussions with any community at this point.
Is there any laws that would prohibit a private pharmacists, if they wanted to accept drugs and redispense them?
Madam Chair and Senator Meyer, there aren't really any laws. What it comes down to really is space, because I don't know if some of the committee members may remember last year when we were actually brought in some pictures of the donated space from the hospital. They were absolutely overflowing with these medications, which was good, but the problem was they were having a real hard time keeping up with even being able to put these in adequate space. They had their bathroom filled up. They were just overflowing. So most pharmacies do not have excess space. The space they have is filled with their medications. And then it's keeping your inventory separate, that type of thing. So I think it would really come down to a space issue more than anything.
Roxanne, could you give us a handout on that? Because I think it's important to Senator Hastert, and I think it would be good information to have. It's been a really positive program for citizens of Wyoming.
Madam Chair, I will absolutely do that.
Thank you, and I think would help the community.
Madam Chair, and just, you know, I just like to, you know, and if you can give us some rough numbers, if some communities are ready, and then I'd like a cost comparison of, you know, if you have some hard facts or just some estimates on, you know, what we spend as to what it saves the state. I know Dr. Sherrard has had some anecdotal stories of, and discussed on the amount it saved getting people away from the ERs, and then the fact that they've been able to sustain medication for a period of time. And I know that there has been a savings to the state because of this.
Madam Chairman, a savings to the state that's very hard to quantify, because I do believe that these drugs keep people out of hospitals. It's just difficult to know exactly how much.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Sherrard and team. And
thank you.
We will contact you if we need to have a call back after we review.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
The information. Thank you so much. Have a good evening. And committee, we're back in here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. 8 a.m.